Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2022. And thank you for joining us. Looking out towards the east or the west from northern Nevada is a welcome and far from guaranteed sight. Snowpack blanketing the Sierra. So much snowfall in the final days of the year, the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab based near Donner Summit recorded its snowiest December on record at more than 17 feet. Department of Water Resources says statewide, the snow water equivalent is 160% of average for this time of year. But as we've come to learn, a stretch of wintry precipitation just chips away at the state's drought conditions. The reality is, when it comes to the water supply to carry us through the drier months, more is needed. And while the snowpack is welcome, it has come at the expense of hazardous conditions for tens of thousands of people living in the foothills who remain without power. And more snow is forecasted this week. Mark Finan is the chief meteorologist at KCRA 3 News and has been tracking and forecasting the weather in Northern California for the past 30 years. Mark joins us now. Really a busy end of 2021, Mark.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, the December certainly was a terrific month for precipitation. And yeah, it certainly got our rain and snow year off to a very good start.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of headlines, record and historic, but what's the context behind these words, record and historic, for December?
Yeah, a very good month, obviously. And you mentioned that the snowpack is at around 160% of average for this time of year or something in that ballpark. The number to remember, though, is the number that we need more like on April 1st. And so far, that number is at around 50%. So in other words, so far, that snowpack is only about half of what we need for an entire season. So if the spigot of storms kind of gets shut off as we go through January, February, and March, we could still end up in a bad situation. And it's interesting, is looking back at the numbers for that record that you mentioned at the Central Sierra Snow Lab, that dated back to 1970. So we had great snowpack at the end of December 1970. However, the next 3 months did not produce, over those 3 months, as much snow as we had in the 1 month of December. So that was another year we had one big month, and then the rest of the year was only so-so. If we do that again this year, we will have less than adequate water supply as we head toward the summer.
Yeah, and that's just so important to keep in mind. You know, as you were tracking the weather in the final week or so of 2021, what struck you about the winter systems that were moving through Northern California?
You know, the Sierra numbers weren't very surprising. You know, when we get our good storms, we always talk about we're going to measure in feet. You know, if we get a nice couple of storms, yeah, we'll talk 3 to 6, 4 to 8 feet of snow. And by that, I mean, we're talking about elevations above 6,000 feet, you know, at the resorts way up there. What was more surprising, and we saw it coming, was having the cold air around and how much snow we were going to see at the elevations between 2 and 4,000 feet. Now, that doesn't do much for our water supply and that sort of thing, but it was, we knew that it was going to be a devastating type of storm for the foothills. And but even I was surprised by how many people were without power. I think there was one time last week, there were over 90,000 customers in the foothills, wow, just in six counties that were without power. And I know today there are still tens of thousands that are still without power. So the amount of damage, the thousands of trees that came down, that was what surprised me, was the amount of snow we saw between, let's say, 2,500 feet and 4,000 feet and how much damage that did.
Well, for people living in the foothills still without power, what should they keep in front of mind heading into a week of more active weather?
Well, the good thing is that as we are going to get a little bit more rain and snow tonight, that the snow levels will be going up. And I know that there is still an impact even today in the foothills, not just without the power, but there are a lot of roads that are still covered in ice, especially in shady areas that haven't gotten much sun in the last couple of days. It is going to get warmer over the next couple of days. And the snow that we're going to be looking at tonight, tomorrow, will generally be above 5,000 feet. And later on this week, it'll get warmer still. The incoming weather obviously isn't going to be great news for PG&E crews that are going to be out there and the other people that are out there trying to get things back on track. But generally, we are going to see warmer. And I guess that's good news for the folks in the foothills, that we are not going to be seeing anything more in the way of snow in the foothills.
You know, Mark, I mean, this is also the 25th anniversary of the 1997 floods. I mean, hefty snowpack coupled with a warm system leading to devastating flooding across the Sacramento Valley. You were there. You guided people through this time as a meteorologist. When I see the snowpack now, I get a little weary. Does this concern you, too, or are the conditions different this time?
The conditions are different. As we got into the floods of 97, the preceding conditions, yeah, we had a huge snowpack. We had a relatively low snowpack from a storm that we had had previous. And then we got a big atmospheric river event that dumped a lot of rain. But what happened before that was that the reservoirs were already at a pretty high level and they were already dumping water. So you think about, there was water coming out of Shasta, Oroville, and Folsom already. So when the big storm came, the releases out of those large reservoirs was even bigger. That's how we ended up getting big flows on the Sacramento, the Feather, and the American River. And eventually we had a lot of levee breaks, which led to so much of the damage in 97. We don't have that. And that's another thing that I want to talk about in terms of our where we are in terms of our water supply. A lot of people have been talking about how they're letting water out of Folsom. Well, they need to, in case we get another big storm. They need to keep it just about where it is now. But if you look at the real big reservoirs, Shasta and Oroville, right now they are, I think that's only about 26% of capacity at Shasta and in the mid 30% range on Oroville. So there is a lot of room in those reservoirs, and those are the two big reservoirs that need to be have much more water in them by the time we get to May, let's say, in order to say that the drought is over. If those two are above 80 or 90% by the time we get to May, then we can say we've done significant progress on getting rid of the drought. But that's the big difference between now and 1997. In 1997, there was a lot of water in the reservoirs before the big storm even happened.
How do you reflect on that time in 1997?
Well, it was big. And I've just recently was going through a lot of the video and a lot of the stories about what happened then. And this morning on January 3rd was when we saw the huge levee break on the Feather River that went through all of Hearst and Arboga and flooded thousands of homes. And, you know, when I reflect on it, I just keep reminding myself that this can and it will happen again. While we've been talking about drought, Northern California will have another big flood sometime. We always have. We are better prepared than we were in 1997, but still there will come a time we'll get a big storm. We'll have huge flows on some of our rivers. There will likely be levee breaks, and there will be problems caused by flooding. Yeah, like I said, we've been talking about drought for a long time, but there is another flood in our future, and we always have to be mindful of that.
Yeah. You've been a meteorologist at KCRA alone for 3 decades. California obviously has extreme weather patterns. How has forecasting evolved for you over the decades?
You know, it's also interesting looking back at the storm of 97. When we were forecasting that, we didn't do a 7-day forecast, we did a 5-day forecast. Our 7-day forecasts are much more accurate than our old 5-day forecasts were. So things are getting better. We can see things better farther out. We have more tools. We have more information. Also, you know, just thinking about 1997, we had, I think in the newsroom, we had one or two computers that were hooked up to this thing called the internet, where we could download information and find out what river levels were like and what flows were like and that sort of thing. And so now we have so much more information available at our fingertips, so that if there is a high level going down the Cosumnes, we know it. It's forecasted better. So we are getting better. Data is so much better. And I think that as we go forward the next 20 or 30 years, we'll continue to see weather forecasting evolve and continue to get better.
Well, as we are chatting over Zoom and technology has clearly evolved, what do you still find challenging about your work?
You know, the day-to-day forecast is a challenge. I mean, if you just look at what we had last week, you know, we were in the office going back and forth about what the snow levels were going to be. It's the details of the forecast that to me make it fun and a challenge every day. So it's the details. Was the snow level going to be at 2,000, 2,500, 3,000? And how much snow was there going to be? So it's the details. And even like what we're looking at today, tonight, we're going to be seeing that snow level rise. So where is that snow level going to end up? Where is the rain snow line even going to be? And then even within our viewing area, Stockton may not get any rain this time around, while Marysville may do pretty well. So it's little details like that I find the challenge you know, the I think the more information we have, the more information people want. And that's our challenge, is to provide that.
Well, given you touched upon this in the beginning, that historically the most important snow surveys are approaching March and April, a lot can change between now and then. Given that snowpack is, you know, roughly a third of the state's water supply, what should we keep in mind?
Well, we should keep in mind that we do need more. And, you know, a foot of snow here, a foot of snow there is fine. But I know a lot of people, I had people send me pictures from the Sierra on Twitter, and they would sarcastically say, so we're still in a drought, ha, ha, ha. And like, yes, we are. So what we have to keep in mind is that while we did see a lot of snow in December, we still need more. And we really need that snowpack to keep filling those reservoirs as we head into the spring and summer months. You know, it's interesting, the snowpack is almost our water supply for 2023. So if you think about what's in the reservoirs now, that's kind of, and what's coming into the reservoirs now, that's kind of our water supply for 2022. And then as that gets replenished with the snowpack that melts in the spring and summer, that's our water for 2023. So it's kind of our savings account. And coming out of the drought, or hopefully coming out of the drought, what we need is to have a lot of snowpack to replenish those reservoirs. And that basically gives us a two-year water supply. So yeah, I know a lot of people think that just one good month is going to get us out of this drought, but one good month doesn't end 2 years of dry weather.
Yeah, I think of like the punny phrase, drop in the bucket. I mean, that gets used a lot, a good amount for when it comes to this topic. So, I mean, essentially, yeah. Is this a drop in the bucket when it comes to the bigger picture of the state's water supply?
It's more than a drop. You know, we're doing really well. You know, to have 50% of our season total, if you will, in terms of snowpack at this time of year, that's great. But what we can't do is to, you know, have a pattern that's dry into January, February, and March. We need a steady succession of storms, and it would be good if we had another one or two really big ones to give us another 5 or 6 feet, you know, over the course of a few days. That would be terrific. You know, it's interesting, Vicki, we've been talking about 1997. And we had all of that that big storm around the New Year's, and that was a very warm storm with the snow level up around 10,000 feet, but we had good storms going into that. That year, despite the fact that we had flooding, the snowpack ended up below average by the time we got to April. And the reservoirs, because they had to dump so much water and the snowpack was below average, the reservoirs were not full by the time we get to the month of May. So it's, while I would say we're off to a really good start to our rain and snow season, I would say that the next 3 to 4 months are still really critical for our water storage as well as for our drought.
Yeah, that hindsight is just so important. Before we let you go, more snow and rain obviously forecasted this week. You're talking about the details. You cover such a broad area and such diverse terrain. What are you focusing on this week?
Focusing on those snow levels rising, mindful of the people in the foothills that were without power, as well as the PG&E crews that are out there and what they may be dealing with. Mindful that there are still people that need to travel through the Sierra and what the chain control situation is going to be. We could see a foot of snow over the next 24 hours in the high Sierra, above 5,000 feet. So that will get us back into chain controls, although I don't think we'll get into the road closure sort of situation we saw over the Christmas weekend. And then we'll keep an eye on the next one for Friday and into Saturday and how much that is going to give us. But that too looks like it's going to be warmer. And so right now, again, mindful of the impact that this weather this week is going to have on people without power, people trying to restore power, and people trying to travel. So those are the kind of details we're looking at this week. Timing out the rain tonight, tomorrow, and then likely coming in Friday, maybe Friday afternoon, end into Saturday. So it's timing, amounts, and impact. That's what I'm focusing on this week.
Mark, great talking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Vicki, thank you so much for having me.
Mark Finan is the chief meteorologist at KCRA 3 News. Up next, infectious disease specialists at UC Davis and UCSF explain the latest science on the spread of the Omicron variant and their thoughts on the CDC's updated guidance on quarantining. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It may be a new year, but the start of this year feels similar to the last, and not in a good way. COVID-19 remains largely in charge as cases in the U.S. soared to their highest levels as we turn the calendar to 2022. This winter surge is primarily driven by the highly contagious Omicron variant. Over the holidays, California passed 5 million total COVID-19 cases since the start of the pandemic. As of today, the daily average of new cases in California is now over 15,000, with a test positivity rate of nearly 16%. Despite the sharp rise in cases, however, there is glimmers of hope. Thanks largely to vaccines, deaths and hospitalizations are not spiking as sharply, and the numbers overall are significantly lower than last year's winter surge. Here to put more context behind the Omicron science and headlines are Dr. Dean Blumberg, Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis, and Dr. Monica Gandhi, Infectious Disease Specialist at UC San Francisco. Dr. Blumberg and Dr. Gandhi, welcome back to Insight and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you too.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I want to ask the both of you. I remember for myself when first hearing about the Omicron variant, I think it was during the Thanksgiving holiday. It's kind of like that familiar demoralized sigh of not again. That was roughly 6 weeks ago. But with both of your expertise, was this predictable or expected, or did this latest spike in cases amid another variant surprise you? Dr. Gandhi?
You know, unfortunately, surprised me because India was the first detection of the Delta variant at 4% vaccination rate. South Africa, first detection of the Omicron variant at a 25% vaccination rate. Though we've had vaccines now for a full year, we haven't worked hard enough as a global community on vaccine equity. And that means that variants can always emerge until we can get there.
Dr. Blumberg?
I think we, as Dr. Gandhi mentioned, we're always going to expect new variants to occur, especially with so much transmission occurring worldwide. The thing that's difficult to put into perspective is when we hear about these variants, it's how seriously should we take them? Because there's been a lot of variants, and some of these end up going nowhere despite some concerning mutations, and other of them end up being very important, like Delta and Omicron. So it's hard to put these into perspective when they initially are identified, but Omicron certainly is the real deal.
Dr. Blumberg, you're based at UC Davis Medical Center here in Sacramento. What are you seeing locally?
We're starting to see an increase in hospitalizations in the pediatric age group, as well as in adults. It's a mild increase compared to the previous surge that we saw. And I think this is largely due to pre-existing immunity. So at this point in the pandemic, most people have either been vaccinated, and if they're not vaccinated, many of them have been infected. So that when these infections then occur, there's some sort of partial immunity in place that results in mild infection. Some of the researchers are saying that Omicron by itself causes milder infection, but you know, I really haven't seen any clinical data that has compared initial infection with Omicron with initial infection with other variants. So I'm not sure if Omicron by itself is causing milder infection or if it's due to pre-existing immunity.
Dr. Gandhi, the Bay Area has overall a high rate of vaccination. What are you seeing in your area?
Yes, the same thing that Dr. Blumberg just said, that we are having much, much lower hospitalizations. So across the city of San Francisco, 896,000 people we still have less than around two over 100,000 hospitalizations, despite much, much increasing cases. I think there are two reasons for this profound decoupling really between cases and hospitalizations. And the main one is what Dr. Bloomberg said. It really is high rates of immunity in our population. We have a over 80% vaccination rate. And then, right, there's natural immunity in people who haven't seen it before. And then maybe the Omicron, the laboratory studies are curious and interesting that it doesn't seem to infect lung cells as well. These are now five studies, including three in hamsters and then two in ex vivo lung models.
Where are we with Delta? Because we're hearing a lot about Omicron. Is Delta still very much present in our area, Dr. Bloomberg?
Yeah, we're still seeing Delta. We're seeing that the Omicron accounts for somewhere around 60% of cases, but the rest of them are Delta. So both of them are circulating at the same time, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays itself out.
Dr. Gandhi, is that the same in the Bay Area?
Yes, though I have to say we don't do well enough sequencing. There was this confusing moment with the CDC that they said 74% of cases are Omicron and then revised it. It's 59% countrywide. It is going to take over Delta almost completely, but it's hard to tell if we're at 40% or 30% Delta. We definitely still have Delta, but I don't think anyone knows without great genomic surveillance how much is each variant. Hmm.
Given that both of you are infectious disease physicians, I mean, there's robust dialogue and debate within the medical community about the best way to move forward amid COVID and a pandemic going into a third year. What kind of conversations are you having among your peers, Dr. Bloomberg?
You know, one of the interesting things is to start thinking of a post-pandemic world. And I think that we're getting there and that we have so much pre-existing immunity from vaccination and prior infection so that we can start thinking about COVID soon in a way that we think about influenza, that the vast majority of people are going to have mild infections, which will be disruptive, but not life-threatening, not resulting in hospitalization and not resulting in death. And then we can return our society back to pre-pandemic level where people can make their own risk assessments about whether they want to be in crowds and mask and those sorts of issues.
Dr. Gandhi?
Yes, I completely agree. You know what? A year ago, we had to do whatever in our power to decrease cases because we didn't have vaccines. So that was masking, distancing, ventilation, contact tracing, testing, everything in our power. What do we have now? We have increasing immunity. The safest way to get to have gotten there was vaccinations, but not everyone vaccinated. And in that setting, cases and hospitalizations are so delinked that what we have to do now is try to control hospitalizations and use that as our metric of success. And for example, at a typical influenza year, we never want this in COVID, by the way, but we're at about 50 over 100,000 hospitalizations in a typical influenza year. In places that are highly vaccinated, we're less than five COVID hospitalizations over 100,000. It's more deadly than the flu, so we want to keep it lower. But that's where we're getting to with immunity. And then after this, exactly right. I think we have to think about if you want to indoor mask, if you're at high risk, that is definitely something you may want to do, but it is an endemic virus. It's going to stay with us. We're going to have some hospitalizations, but the immunity is keeping it much, much lower.
Yeah, I can't help but think about all of those people working in hospitals, saving people's lives and just being honestly just exhausted after going into 3 years of this in the hospital. What conversations are you hearing about the fatigue among frontline workers in hospitals?
Yeah, I can say that I've heard that too, that a lot of people have been very frustrated. People, some people do feel that they're overworked. There is some burnout. Some physicians and nurses have decided to retire, that this would be a great time to retire. You know, I don't want to go through another pandemic like this. I kind of joke and say this is my last pandemic that I want to go through certainly as a professional. But I think it's also, you know, a time where it's very rewarding to be a healthcare worker also, that you really feel, you know, that you're doing so much good, that you're taking care of people who need it. So it's a tremendous opportunity also.
Dr. Gandhi?
Yes, I agree. It was exhausting. It also in terms of just what it took to get to the vaccine and to get to these high rates of immunity. But it is amazing to have been able to get a vaccine within 9 months of the pandemic being declared, be able to educate the public, to get people to take the vaccine, maybe not everyone, and I'm sorry about that, but as much as we could, and to see it simmer away from what before to now, which is low hospitalizations in places of high immunity. That is a total blessing. Different than our last pandemic in 1918, which took so many more lives because we couldn't and didn't have an influenza vaccine until 1942.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with infectious disease physicians at UC Davis and UCSF about the latest science of the Omicron variant. The CDC is facing some criticisms when they shortened the recommended quarantine period for asymptomatic people from 10 days to 5. I mean, the pushback was arguably that this was a decision driven by economics rather than science or public health. But from your perspective, is there science to support the CDC's decision, Dr. Blumberg?
You know, that's, I think, a very good question. And looking at the data, I think, is very important. And I haven't seen the data yet. So I'd love to see the data for which they based this decision on. In the past, they've been very transparent with the data and released that. But I just still haven't seen that. So it's really hard to form an opinion. On a practical sense, though, if you look at the models, they suggest that this current surge due to Omicron will start peaking sometime in February in the US, and there'll be almost 3 million new infections every day. You know, that's huge, and that would be so disruptive to everybody, not just healthcare workers, but to entire industries. And so in a practical sense, I think it does make some sense in order to keep people working if they feel that they're not that sick and are able to. Of course, the trade-off is if people are out and about, they could transmit more infections. So I would love to see the data. I just haven't seen it yet. Maybe Dr. Gandhi has more insight into this than I do.
Yeah, Dr. Gandhi. Okay, yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, they did finally post, you're right, at the beginning it was a little confusing. And then they really did post kind of a detailed science brief about why they went down to 5 days. And one thing that was really helpful to see is that the largest contact tracing study that we've looked at in terms of transmission was published in JAMA late last year from Taiwan. And it's not just the majority of transmission occurs within the 5 days, it's actually all of it. So there was literally zero transmissions that occurred in this very well done contact tracing study at day six or above. And so I think that's the best data to say that yes, 5 days is where 100% of the transmissions occur. I thought that was very convincing, you know, JAMA study. And so that I think is their main reason to say, okay, 5 days isolation is enough. It's not really on viral load. It's not really on testing. It really has to do with a good contact tracing study that formed their recommendation. So I think 5 days being in isolation is the right approach given. And then they do recommend masking very well from the days 5 to 10. But I think it is the right approach at this time in the pandemic. We have the vaccines and we have a very highly transmissible variant that likely is to come down. The viral load may come down even more quickly with such a high viral load. And hopefully this is the right thing to get us back to. We have to still have life and we have the vaccine. So I think it was the right thing that they did.
Yeah. Another piece of this conversation are testing or is testing. And during the holidays, I mean, it was like nearly impossible for people to find rapid tests. How effective are rapid tests in detecting the Omicron variant, Dr. Gandhi?
Well, they are effective. I mean, actually, there was some confusion that like they wouldn't pick up the just because it has, you know, mutations across it, but they are effective. The issue about all of our tests is they each have limitations. So you can be infectious before you get symptoms. Then it's usually for the first, basically the contact tracing study showed us you're getting infectious for 5 days after getting symptoms. So one rapid test does not tell you, you know, unless you tested very frequently, if you still have virus in your nose, and then PCR can pick up really low amounts of virus where you're not infectious. So that was another thing that the CDC said in their recommendations is that we have to admit the limitations of the two types of tests we have. And if you have a positive test, then please stay away from others for the next 5 days and then keep a mask on for the following 5 days. But we have limitations of these tests and no one can test as frequently as we'd need to really block the chains of transmission.
I mean, we're going into a week where people are returning to work and families are dropping children off at school. Dr. Blumberg, your specialty is pediatric infectious diseases. And you did say that pediatric hospitalizations are going up when it comes to COVID. So how is the Omicron variant affecting children? Essentially, what do families need to know?
Well, there is no vaccine available for children less than five, and so they remain vulnerable to infection. And for the 5 to 11-year-olds, we only had a recent recommendation for immunization, and we only have about 25% vaccination rate in that group. So they're going to be more vulnerable to infection than older individuals who have higher vaccination rates. And so we may see that. That's why I think that's what is driving the increase in cases, the increase in proportion of cases that are pediatric cases. You know, the good news is that it's generally less severe in children, but I'd like to caution people to remember that less severe doesn't mean that it's not severe. That certainly there's been, you know, thousands of cases of hospitalization, more than 1,000 deaths of children in the U.S. So it can be quite severe. And I personally can attest to seeing children in the ICU on ventilators and being very sick. So we want to prevent infection in everybody, and specifically, you know, in children, we want to keep them healthy.
Yeah. And with that in mind, you know, we also know that distance learning in the last, you know, or the first year and a half of the pandemic was also devastating to children as well. When talking about a post-pandemic world that potentially could be in 2022, what do you envision for families and schools, Dr. Blumberg?
Well, I'm hopeful that schools have as high a vaccination rate as possible among teachers, staff, and students, so that in-person learning can remain and that schools remain safe environments for children where transmission is minimized. We know that in-person learning is important for children's mental health and for their physical health, and so we'd really like to maximize the chances for that to remain.
And Dr. Gandhi, I know that you just joined us a few weeks ago when asking for state public health officials to kind of create an off-ramp and to incentivize families when it comes to vaccinations. What do you envision for 2022 when it comes to children going back to school?
So I am also disappointed, along with Dr. Blumberg, that the low rates of vaccination of 5 to 11-year-olds in this country, it's 10 micrograms, it's safe. In fact, there was a large 5 million person real world study that showed that the vaccine is very safe in 5 to 11 year olds. So I do think we need ways to incentivize vaccination. I think going back to normal is a way to incentivize vaccination. That was actually true of adults as well. Unfortunately, we only have a 62% vaccination rate in this country. But this idea that you vaccinate and that you get normal life and that you have off ramps and that you don't mask, that you have normal, going back to normal life, I think is something that we haven't used enough in our country in terms of incentivizing.
Before we let you both go, just some people who are fully vaccinated, even boosted, are feeling pandemic fatigue. I was obviously looking at memes ending 2021, and there was one where it said, like, 2020 was mask up, 2021 was get vaccinated, and 2022 is it is what it is. And I think that really hits home that people are frustrated that they've done everything right. The pandemic is still very much here. How are conversations changing or evolving for the both of you as physicians? Dr. Blumberg?
Well, as Dr. Gandhi mentioned, the metric we really should be following is hospitalizations and death. That's the most important thing that we want to prevent. You know, if people get breakthrough infection, if they're vaccinated, they get a mild breakthrough infection, they miss school or work for a few days, and they're home with an outpatient illness. You know, that's inconvenient, but it's not that big of a deal. And we all deal with that pre-pandemic where we get the cold, we get a flu, that happens. And that's not a big deal. People shouldn't panic about that kind of a breakthrough infection. If we're preventing the vast majority of hospitalizations and death due to COVID, that's a victory. We've succeeded and we can congratulate ourselves and move forward. So that's what I see in our future.
Dr. Gandhi, what do you see in the future?
The exact same thing, that I think we need to move away from case counts, because case counts are unreliable, depends on how much you're testing. But also, of course, an asymptomatic breakthrough doesn't mean what it meant before, because you're vaccinated, and also mild symptoms don't proceed to severe disease in the setting of vaccination. So we will have to live with that, with an endemic virus, but our metric of success being reducing hospitalizations and deaths allow us, even now at this phase of the pandemic, if we move to that metric, then we can say the pandemic is, quote, not done, but with us and in a controllable phase.
Dr. Blumberg and Dr. Gandhi, I mean, there's just so much information still coming at us. So thank you for helping it make it a little bit more digestible and understandable. Appreciate you for joining us.
Thank you. And stay healthy.
Yes, stay healthy. Dr. Dean Blumberg is the chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis. Dr. Monica Gandhi is an infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco. Both are sharing their scientific expertise on this year's winter COVID surge and what we can expect heading into 2022. Still ahead, remembering beloved Sacramento legends Joan Didion and Wayne Thiebaud. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The final days of 2021 marked goodbyes for two beloved Sacramento artistic geniuses in their own right, renowned artist Wayne Thiebaud and literary legend Joan Didion. Inspired by the seemingly simple and unassuming, honing in with creative precision, allowing us to reflect on the easily overlooked rhythms of life and leave with a deeper significance. Both Thiebaud and Didion have fame spanning generations and a reach well beyond the Sacramento Valley, but Sacramento was a foundational influence for their artistic roots, inspired by the California experience. Joan Didion passed away in New York at the age of 87. Her childhood home off T and 22nd Street in Sacramento has become an anchor of beloved pride for those shaped by her essays, novels, and memoirs for the past 50 years. Wayne Thiebaud passed away on Christmas Day at the age of 101 in Sacramento. Known for iconic paintings dating back to the 1960s of California's landscape and everyday life, but the Sacramento State graduate taught at UC Davis for more than 40 years, shaping artists to this very day. We're going to take some time remembering both. Shelley Blanton Stroud is an author and co-director of Stories on Stage Sacramento. Rachel Teagle is the founding director of the Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. Welcome both to Insight.
Thank you.
Morning.
So
yeah, I wanted to start off by asking both of you, how were you shaped by Joan Didion and Wayne Thiebaud? Shelley?
Joan Didion writes about how she began her self-training as a writer by typing Ernest Hemingway's sentences. Well, when I decided I wanted to be a writer, I typed Joan Didion's sentences. There's this clarity and this crispness and alertness and aliveness. Because of reading so much of her work and focusing on her style, I definitely try to remove breathlessness from my writing. I always start with a certain amount of it, but it needs editing out. I dislike using much unneeded description. Another thing about it is about her influence on me is because of how much I love her work, I really aim to be unsentimental and yet honest about feeling, not to be remote or without feeling, but to be unsentimental about it, as Didion did. And then I guess the last thing I would say about that is that in the novels that I write, I absolutely love to write about a hard-eyed, ambitious, essentially moral, but also naughty girl. And there's a lot of Didion in that.
Rachel, you actually knew Wayne Thiebaud. How were you shaped by his work?
Wayne really taught me how art of all kinds has a much broader impact than we ever guess. He and his students always talked about Wayne Thiebaud didn't teach them how to paint. Wayne Thiebaud taught them how to see the world, how to go slowly and really look at something and see it in all its facets. And that is an essential life skill that enriches lives far beyond the lives of artists.
Rachel, you and UC Davis celebrated Thiebaud's 101st birthday in November. I mean, what a special moment, a little over a month before his passing.
It was an incredible opportunity to share with Wayne, because what we did was we showed him the artists who were going to carry his legacy into the next 100 years. And both the artists who were participating and Wayne, I think, were very personally touched by how much teachers shape you for the rest of your very life.
Did teaching add a meaningful dimension to Thiebaud as an artist? I mean, he kept doing it for decades and he stayed in Sacramento. What do you think he got out of that?
Well, I know teaching was fundamental to Wayne. If you look at any of the New Yorker covers, and there were a lot that he made over the years, in his capsule biography, he could have listed, he literally won every major award an artist in the United States could win. And he listed himself as a professor at UC Davis because teaching and the exchange, what he got back from his students, was fundamental to his work, but also fundamental to his worldview, that teaching and learning are the most fundamental practice that any human being can pursue. And I think Sacramento, well, I think one of the things he shares with Joan Didion was a sense of Californianess. Wayne's work was fundamentally rooted in California. I think he loved living in Sacramento because it put a little distance between him and what he would call the perils of the art market. But he also, an important thing for all of us to remember when we look out at the Delta and think of those Wayne Thiebaud images, he loved the light in Sacramento, the clear, dry light that allows you to see the world more clearly. It's special in Sacramento and something I hope everybody thinks about today.
Yeah. Yeah, Shelley, often when I think about books that I read, I think about them alongside a time in my life. Was there a specific moment in your life where Didion's work resonated with you?
I think that when I was about 25 years old and I was rereading Slouching Toward Bethlehem, you know, having graduated from college and being in grad school myself, it was sort of time to think about what I believed about the world and who I was going to be as an adult. And there were certain essays in Slouching Toward Bethlehem that, because I read them then, they've kind of had an outsized effect on me. In particular, both on writing, keeping a notebook, and on self-respect. One thing that she writes, I don't have the quote right in front of me, but it means a lot to me. I'll take the risk of paraphrasing, which is that that you have to be willing to look harshly and directly at your past, at the people you've known, the people who raised you, the place you've grown up, because if you avoid looking at the past, you will not be able to sustain that avoidance it's going to come for you. And she says it'll come for you at 3 a.m. in the morning and wake you up and demand a reckoning. And I sort of felt at that age of about 25 that reading those essays that deal with what a person ought to do to understand themselves, it was very meaningful to me. And it kind of set me on a path of wanting to deconstruct the life that I had led, the place I was from, and how that affected my going forward.
Yeah, I'm rereading the White Album, and I started that in the final weeks or final days of 2021. How did Joan Didion inspire and shape a new generation of writers, Shelley? Because you also taught writing to students as a college professor at Sac State.
Yes, and I did. Often I would teach those two essays I mentioned before, and my students weren't like Joan Didion. I mean, she came from a certain stratosphere in Sacramento. She went to high school with the future Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's sister Nancy, with California Governor Earl Warren's daughter Nina. In college, she was friends with Barbara Brown, daughter of the soon-to-be Governor Pat Brown. She came from a level or a class of Sacramentans that was different than many of my students at Sacramento State, many of whom were first-time university students in their family. And yet, oh my gosh, did they connect with her message of identifying the moral core of their own self, their ability to choose who they would be and how they would be it. And also, I think they found it very freeing. A lot of times with freshmen, I would have them read Joan Didion just before Thanksgiving, because I knew that it would be interesting to hear her talk about excavating your memories of childhood right before going home, so they could be alert to who have I always been, who am I now, who am I aiming to be. And I think my students wrote some amazing essays provoked by that challenge she lays down in her essays.
Oh, that's just wonderful. Rachel, I was watching a conversation that you had with Wayne Thiebaud around his 101st birthday, shortly before his passing. And he said that Davis represents one of the more curious art departments. It has a condition of absence. And actually, I joined you in thinking, what does that mean as a response? I mean, I took it as he likened it to a blank canvas. How did you interpret how he described UC Davis and the art community?
Well, you know, Vicki, so much of what Zoe's describing about Joan Didion really applies to Wayne's worldview. You have to know yourself as an artist to really make great work. One of his students, Christopher Brown, told me that Wayne Thiebaud taught him how to find the Grand Canyon in the corner of his studio, meaning that there's majesty all around us if you can just find it. But that process is inherently a solo endeavor. You have to know yourself, you have to dig into yourself, and that's what I think he ultimately meant by a condition of absence. Teachers weren't telling you what to make at UC Davis. In fact, it was a point of pride that at UC Davis they challenged you to find yourself in the studio, and those are the conditions that could open up great work.
Thiebaud gifted 24 artworks to UC Davis. That, of course, is generous. But also what it demonstrates is the value in not just observing and being inspired by what's around us, but actually being part of a community. I mean, that seems to be an important message or legacy that he wanted to leave behind.
Well, especially the teaching community. He wanted his works to be accessible to students. He wanted students to be able to study his work. A few years ago, he gave us an unfinished painting, a beautiful portrait of Betty Jean. Many of your listeners will know his lovely wife, Betty Jean, for many, many years. And he gave us an unfinished work because he said, it's easier for students to crack my code, to see how I did it, by looking at something that's unfinished. And ultimately, what I think Wayne Thiebaud wanted with that gift was to continue to be a teacher for future generations.
In the last minute or so that we have, Why do you think both continue to resonate and inspire today and will continue to do so for generations to come? Shelley?
Well, I think there are many writers who are sharply observant, as Joan Didion is. And yet, I think that there aren't so many that combine the ability to actually care very deeply and to be able to access their emotion, and yet to approach the material ruthlessly, that she is so skeptical in investigating even the things and the people she loves, and even why she loves them. And so it leads to some brilliant writing, and I don't see it dropping off. I think that quality of that ruthless interrogation of what she loves and values is something that will last.
Rachel, what do you want to leave us with Wayne Thiebaud?
Again, it's the similarity between the two. I read a beautiful homage to Didion by Zadie Smith, where she said, "You may not agree with what she says, but her sentences take your breath away."
Yeah.
And it's the same with Wayne, how he builds a painting. You know, he was a rigorous, again, digging all unneeded description out of his painting. We had artists from LA, serious artists, come up to see Wayne's work because true painters are inspired by how he builds those images. And I think anyone who cares about the structure of a sentence or the structure of an artwork is going to continue to be looking to Didion and Thiebaud for a very long time.
Yeah, they both show the importance of paying attention, being present, and really just checking in. Shelley and Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. I love this conversation.
Thank you very much. It was an honor to get to have this.
Shelley Blanton Stroud is an author and co-director of Stories on Stage Sacramento. Rachel Teagle is the founding director of the Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, remembering Wayne Thiebaud and Joan Didion. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. First show of 2022 in the books. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.